got all kinds of things. So now that we've calmed down, let me start again. See, Jesus' analysis of belief and unbelief involves God doing the impossible, that is, bringing rich people into the kingdom of heaven. So now I want to spend a little bit of time with you trying to understand wealth and the nowhere generation. I know we haven't come to who they are yet, and how are we going to get to who they are? That's what's going to come. Let me ask why, getting you to ask it, talk to each other again. Why? Why is it impossible for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven? I mean, why is it impossible for anybody? Well, the answer is because of sin. But why in particular is it impossible for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven? There you go, and I'll collect up some answers in a few moments. What's the answer? What are the answers that we have? Yes.
Wealth breeds wealth, so it's difficult not to fall into a trap of consumerism and you end up serving two masters.
Wealth breeds wealth, you fall into consumerism and serving two masters, which we're told is impossible. Yes.
You have more to lose.
You have more to lose, yes. The wealth becomes your security, yes. Yes, it's back to front, isn't it? The first will be last, the last will be first. Because with wealth, you're used to power and everybody's serving you. Whereas the kingdom's all about you serving everybody else. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have more invested in this world if you have more money in this world. So.
You have more invested, that's for sure. When you have more wealth, you invest more, yes? And you're invested more in this world and its systems and its structures and its ways, yes? And there's the great deceitfulness of riches. The riches actually do con us, don't they? Deceive us, yes?
Wealth can bring pride.
Wealth brings pride, yeah?
And that can lead to someone thinking that they know everything themselves.
Yep. With pride comes that arrogance of knowing everything and knowing it all for yourself and knowing how to run life, yes? Whole range of reasons, aren't there? Sorry? Yes, you get really comfortable here, don't you? And especially in Sydney. It's got to be one of the most comfortable places in the world to live in. And Helen always says, if you're going to be a poor person, be poor in a warm climate. And I don't know why she keeps mentioning this to me, but there's great truth in that, isn't there? And this is a place you can... If you're on the streets of London, you only have about 18 months before you're dead. That's just the way it is. It's horrible. It's not actually a joke, that, but, you know. that is the realities. The streets of London are just too cold to actually be out on. It's a dreadful place to be. Whereas London, Sydney, you can stay for donkey's years on the streets of Sydney and live well, I'm sad to say. Okay. Thank you for that. Jesus doesn't explain why, you'll notice, in that passage. No explanation why. The Bible does speak of riches and wealth often. And some of the answers that you've given indicate your biblical knowledge there, don't they? For example, in Matthew 6, no one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and money. Just can't be done. So, of course, if you're serving money, there's no way you'll be serving God. Or 1 Timothy chapter 6 is a passage that addresses the rich and tells them, amongst other things, not to be haughty. The trouble with the rich is they put their hope in this world, some of the things that you are saying. Rather than using their money for the age to come, they become self-satisfied with this world and not concerned about the next. Mark chapter 4, someone mentions the deceitfulness of riches, and then you get the parable of the sower, which is in Mark 4 and Matthew 13. And the deceitfulness of riches comes out in the third soil, if you remember, that just chokes the word from you. It's the cares and worries and pleasures of the world. And our money gives us cares and worries and pleasures. And it chokes the word out of us. You see, the rich have too many options in life. Too big a bucket list. In fact, you have to be rich to have a bucket list. If you're a poor person in Eritrea, you don't even have a bucket, let alone a bucket list. The idea, well, I must see the Taj Mahal before I die. You know, I mean, I just want to stand there and photograph it. My friends, you can get better photographs off the internet than anyone you'll take of the Taj Mahal, and it'll still be there when you're dead. Don't worry about it. You can give the... Never mind. A photograph of the Taj Mahal has got to be one of the silliest things I've ever heard of. But we have this, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do all these things. There's this bucket list. Fabulously wealthy to be like that. James chapter 4 speaks about the riches of people. In fact, the epistle of James speaks against riches. It's not that there's some virtue in poverty. Poverty's awful. The Bible's always against poverty. You don't want to be poor. But the rich, why, rich Christians are double-minded and distracted by their wealth. And rich non-Christians are indifferent to the gospel and distracted by their wealth. So as we ponder and understand wealth and the nowhere generation, notice first, the first thing we've got to grasp is that Australian wealth is actually a state of mind. It's not just the amount of money you have that makes you wealthy. It's the amount of money that you have that makes you unspiritual, that changes your perspective of yourself and your world because you think from the viewpoint of wealth and of this world. You see, we tend to think that extravagant wealth is the rich, the super rich. So when Jesus says how hard for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven, well, that's not me because I'm not Mr. Gates. You know, I'm not Mr. Packer. I think of the super rich. He's rich, I'm not, therefore he has to give up everything and follow Jesus, I don't. But as preachers are always trying to point out to us, Australians are amongst the richest people in the world. We have the second highest median income in the world. And not only are we the richest, but 21st century Australians are amongst the richest people in history. So we're not only richer than nearly everybody in the world, we're richer than almost anybody who's ever lived before us. We are significantly and seriously rich. The poorest of us are. See, our homes now are double the size of the 1950 homes. And the number of people in each home is half the number. So that, in fact, Australia has the largest homes in the world. We are the top nation if you measure homes in terms of people per square metre. We're number one in the world and in the history of the world. We're so rich that we've locked ourselves out of ever owning a home. Now that's really rich, isn't it? Or stupid. Or both. Or that might be a tautology. And because we're locked out, we think we're poor. But none of us are hungry. All of us have access to some money. If you've got change in your pocket, you're ahead of most of the people of the world. It's not your possessions, it's being possessed by your possessions. It's thinking from the viewpoint of your possessions. It's wealth is having the opportunity to have choices. Wealth is the opportunity to live differently. Poor people do not have choices, and they can't just choose to live differently. They've just got to try and survive. Survival is not your problem or my problem, and not many Australians' problems, other than the Indigenous Australians. Australia is the land of opportunity, which every migrant family who's come knows it, and over generations they build their wealth, that was unimaginable back in their home country. Now, I'd love to discuss migrant evangelism because it's really such a terrific opportunity, and we're getting somewhere there in Australia. We're seeing more people coming from non-Anglo-Saxon background into the kingdom than we are seeing coming from Anglo-Saxon background into the kingdom, and this is really terrific and exciting. And I'd like to discuss with you about the fact that generations of migrants are different, first generation, second generation, how we... But that's not tonight. That's another topic, another day. Let me turn our attention, though, to generational wealth by spelling it out in terms of three generations of Australians today. The oldest generation, the first generation, and I'm going to now give you some really sweeping generalisations, but I'm happy to come back and fill in details of any of you like, because I'm trying to say those kinds of generalisations which are just so manifestly true statistically that I don't have to justify them. But I'm also attaching it loosely to a book which I found very stimulating and helpful to read a few months ago. It's come out this year. It's a non-Christian book by a man called David Goodhart. He's an Englishman. It's called The Road to Somewhere. And it shows, in the light of the Brexit voting and in the light of the Trump voting, that the societies of the Western world are now becoming deeply divided between, as he would say, somewhere people and anywhere people. And from his analysis of somewhere people and anywhere people, I've come up with nowhere people. That's where the title comes from my reading of David Goodhart. It's a good read, it's an interesting read, just an analysing society, I'd commend it to you. In Australia, you can't be blamed for when you're born. So when I talk critically about each of these generations, don't take it personally, especially if you belong to that generation that takes everything personally. The first oldest generation is the nation builders. This is a group of people who lived through two world wars and a depression. Many of them, many of them were out of work for 1, 2, 3 years through the depression, lived in terrible, terrible poverty. My father used to inflict upon us tripe and chocos as a meal because he thought it was such a good meal, for that's what he lived on in the Depression. I can't stand tripe. And most of you don't know what a choco is. And may I say, blessed upon you that you do not know what they are. After the Second World War, having gone through two world wars and the Depression, that was the generation that built this nation. They were British people. They were Christian. They were deeply divided over Protestantism and Catholicism. Their cultural Christianity was a communal way of living. They lived for each other as a society in a way that we find almost impossible to understand. They married early and they had children. Especially coming back from the Second World War, they had many, many, many children. It's called the baby boomer generation. They lived in towns, they lived in suburbs. They didn't live in the inner city unless they were poor, and they certainly didn't live in the central business district. They didn't like living in high rise. They didn't have any high rise, but they didn't like living in lifts. They didn't have motor cars, refrigerators, washing machines. They lived on their quarter acre blocks and raised their families there. And they went to church because the society closed down on weekends. They identified themselves with their place, with their locality, because they couldn't travel. They didn't travel, but they were community-minded people. They didn't have television, so they went out at night, socialising up and down around the streets, walking with each other. And their clubs were local clubs. They were deeply committed to Eastern Suburbs Rugby League Club or St George Rugby League Club, or the locality of the club mattered because the people who played in those clubs came from their locality. They were small town people even when they were in the suburbs. The next generation, the second generation, were their children, the baby boomers. They were the anywhere people. They grew up with the growing wealth of their parents in a time of peace and prosperity. They didn't face a world war. They didn't face a depression. There was almost a recession in 1961, but it was just an almost one. They were the first generation to go to university. Their parents didn't go to university. They were the first generation to go to university. They were anti their parents, though. They were anti-British. They were anti-Christian. The 1960s sexual revolution changed the way they thought and lived. The 1970s brought in multiculturalism as we got rid of the White Australia policy. The 1970s brought in feminism. The 1980s brought in the materialism of greed is good. They were hard science, technology, materialistic people. And they were the first family of Australians raised in divorced families and under child maintenance. These were the people who lived, well, anywhere. For they no longer defined themselves by their location. Those who grew up in a country town left as soon as they could to come to university, never to return. And they travelled. They travelled overseas, lots, in ways their parents never could even imagine doing. And they gave up economic protectionism and became citizens of the world with a global economy. There's the baby boomers. Tony, where did you grow up? Lismore. When did you leave Lismore?
As soon as I could.
As soon as he could. What age was that?
18.
18. Why?
University.
How long have you lived back in Lismore since? Never, exactly. Classic. Did your parents go to university? No. See? First generation, university, leave home, no longer a Lismore boy. Lived more time out of Lismore than in Lismore. The third generation are the children of the baby boomers. They're known as millennials, but I have to be very, very careful about what I say about them, because part of their culture is to be soft and inclusive, and they're easily offended by as victims of misrepresentation from grumpy old men. The millennials move from anywhere to nowhere, for they were born into wealthy, international-minded families. Their parents were anywhere people, so they were a generation further removed from somewhere. They were part of a city that had become a global city. They took tertiary education as kind of normal. No big deal going to university, doesn't everybody? And they grew up in a society which was not Anglo, Christian, cultural. It was a multicultural society, which then automatically became relativistic about religion and about morality. Their morality was no longer personal morality, it's much more social morality. They were well indoctrinated to be green, progressive, and inclusive. And they, of course, were the children of dysfunctional families and the computer world, which then makes them isolated into individualism. As I said, sweeping generalisations. I'm not talking about every individual. Please do not take offence. Now, if the cap fits, wears it, you know, that's all right. Now, I want to leave out the anywhere people so as to help us understand really where we're at and see the difference between the somewhere people and the nowhere people. In summary, it runs something like this, you see. The somewhere people are family people who live in a location, a suburban location, a country town location, and are committed to making that a better place for the society around about. They're working to middle class people and manual workers. A lot of them are tradespeople. They often are migrant people, the first generation in of migrants who are still working in the factories in order that their children may get ahead and go to university and the like. They are conservative because they're hanging on to their cultures from home, and they are generally within society as a whole powerless. Whereas the nowhere people are nearly all child free. That's part of it. You put off children as long as you can and have as few as possible. They are global people who live in the city. They're not interested in country towns. They're not really interested in suburbs. For them, it's the movement from the suburb into Newtown, into the city. They are middle class to upper class people in the Australian working conditions. They tend to become the professional people. There's a greater propensity of them that are the Anglos, and they perceive themselves not as conservatives but progressive, whatever that means. And they are the powerful people, because they control the media, they control politics, they control unions, they control the business world, they control. They are the people in control. Think for a moment, if you want to understand and where this book comes from is the politics, think of it in terms of political terms. When the plebiscite came out, look who the yes voters were, look who the no voters were. It was stark in Sydney more than anywhere else, wasn't it? That the somewhere people lived in a band of migrant suburbia. And the people who voted most firmly for yes lived in this place, Moore College. And no, that's not right. Lived in Newtown, Redfern and the inner city. That is where was the most commonly seen. But you see it also in Brexit. Brexit was a vote against the nowhere people, as was the vote for Mr. Trump. The iron workers, the steel workers who had been out of work in Pennsylvania for generations, they were voting against globalisation. Make America great again. Let us pull back from the world to be ourselves once more. You can see it even in the Queensland election last week. Quite interesting, you see, how the mainstream parties are losing power because our society is becoming more and more divided. But the division was in the extreme ends, the two ends, the division of somewhere and nowhere people. 9% voted Green, and the only seats they're likely to win are in the inner city of Brisbane, where nothing's green. Whereas 13% voted for One Nation and Pauline Hanson, right? But if you check the newspapers, they hardly ever tell you that One Nation outvoted the Greens. That's not really discussed in places like the Sydney Morning Herald, because it's run by nowhere people who are deeply offended by the somewhere people. The somewhere people. You got it wrong. I'm not for One Nation. I'm not against the Greens. Well, and I'm just saying these are the differences. Just a sociological analysis of what is happening in our society. And the nowhere people are everly increasing. And the reaction is therefore getting stronger. And our society is pulling itself apart. Western society is doing that. See, how do you move from being a somewhere person to being a nowhere person? Well, what is it that changes people like this? Well, the key element in America, in Britain and in Australia, the key step is Tony's step, going to university. That's where it happens. That's where a large proportion of the population now are raised up somewhere in a suburb or in a country town, but as soon as possible they're pushed into the university world where they, in their heads, become rich young rulers. They become nowhere people. They do not return back to their suburb. Once they graduate, they start to work in the city. And once they start working in the city, they start moving to other cities, and they meet up with people who've come from not around their suburb but from another part of Sydney, and they marry and go elsewhere if they choose to marry at all, of course, rather than just shack up with one person after another. But they don't let children interfere with their progress in life, because their progress in life is all about material wealth. It's about careerism. It's about themselves and where they're going. It's not about the country town that they've deserted, the suburb they've deserted, or even their family that they've deserted. When it happens is 18 to 30. It's in that period of time, that age phase of life, that the great decisions of the rest of your life are made. By and large, the advertising industry tells us that what a person is by 30 is what a person is going to be by 70. You don't change much. The music you like when you're in your 70s is the music you liked when you're in your 20s. 1170 on the radio station of AM will demonstrate my point to you on that regard. Every decade, they make it 10 years later. Because that's when you came alive. That's when you were not family anymore. You were yourself at that point. The entrance was the university, and beyond that was the work. But the work now dominated your life, not the family, not the home. Different if you're a tradie. Tradies leave school earlier. Tradies work locally. They live locally. The Shire is full of tradies, which is why the inner city laughs at the Shire, because it's a different culture. It's a different way of understanding and living. You come to an inner city church, there are very few two-generational families. There's actually very few families. You go out the Shire, you'll see grandpa and grandma and dad and mum and the children and then even the little babies. 3-4 generations in the same church. It's a different way of understanding. You're a somewhere person as opposed to a nowhere person. And the difference lies in the effect of wealth. That's where it happens. See, from 18 to 30, now, then the baby boomers, more people go on to year 12 than have ever done before. When I was growing up, the majority have left school at 15 or 16. Large numbers went into trades, many more couldn't go into trades. It was a minority actually finished year 12. Well, we didn't finish year 12 because being much more intelligent, we only had 5 years of high school. We didn't need a 6-year like you guys did. But most didn't go to the leaving certificate. And even those who did go to the leaving certificate, most didn't go on to university. Even when I came to Moore College here in the 1960s, the majority of students in Moore College were not university graduates. They were bank tellers, they were barbers, they were clerks in offices, they were retail assistants who were in the students of Moore College. Whereas today you come into Moore College, they're doctors, lawyers, dentists, they're engineers, they're scientists, there's very few without university degrees. Some have PhDs before they come to Moore College. There's a shift, of quite enormous shift, from one generation to the next. And the courses at uni get longer and longer and longer. They're talking about primary school teachers needing 5 years at university to teach in primary school. We were taught by teachers who only had 2 years, which may explain a lot. And we've got to go longer and longer. We've got to do double degrees. Double degrees, complete phony, of course. It just means the university gets more money out of the government. And if everybody gets a double degree, then everybody's degree's halved in value, isn't it? And that's what's happened. There are fewer and fewer people going into trades, which is why tradies are now making lots of money, because there's so few of them anymore. But there's also the social... marriage is getting later and later. When I was a young man, the average age of marriage was 21 for the males and 19 for the females. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Because now people don't get married till their 30s. The average age of having children was in the first child was in the low 20s, 23, 24. Now the average age of having the first child is 30, 31. I may say medically one is a lot healthier than the other. And they have fewer and fewer children. And therefore, of course, fewer and fewer grandchildren for the baby boomers. And more people are travelling for pleasure, taking a gap year. That was unthought of in my generation, a gap year. And to travel around the world just for pleasure, to go to Bali and get stuck there because the volcano, that was an unthought of possibility. And the idea that you would travel for work and that you would be in companies that took you in other places, that was an unthought of thing. And all these things people don't notice, but they meant that you were loosed from your family. You were loosed from the place of origin, from place itself, from your roots. You're inducted into a world and taken on a 12-year journey that breaks all your relationships. It's not simply the changes, it's the transitions that you go through in those changes. As you adapt to new situations, one after another after another, so in your adaptations, your identity changes as to who you are as a person. And you accommodate yourself to the new reality, to the new experiences. So let me show you a quick progress of a nowhere person. They leave school, go on a gap year, then go to university, have their first job, and then they go flatting, they go interstate, they fall in love, they go overseas, they find their second job, they have their heart broken, they go to their third job, they get engaged, they do their MBA, and they come back and get married and have children and go to suburbia. That's what happened between 18 and 30, 18 and 40. That's what happens. But the suburbia they go back to is a different suburbia because they're a different person. For all those years of being a nowhere person, you don't go back happily into being a somewhere person. And you carry with it change. That is how the society has been changing since the 1960s. Transforming young adults into a different kind of person to live in the suburbs and raise their children. And the next generation is more radicalised than the previous generation. And so it goes on. But it all is money. It's wealth. Only a rich society can do this. Let me try and show you a picture of it. So look at the picture of our students from 2017. There they are, happy group of people there. You see, I think that picture goes on the front of your outline too, right? But starting with the one closest to me, furthest away from me, is Candy. She's just married, on a honeymoon at the moment. She comes from Hong Kong. She's growing up in Sydney, speaks Cantonese and Mandarin, and she's just married and is going to minister in New Zealand, in Auckland, where she's never had anything to do with anything there before. John, I'll explain John in a moment. Behind him is Greg. Greg's gone back to minister in Melbourne, is not with us tonight because of that. Peter, we know, comes from Belfast, and we're sending him back. Talar is up there at the other end of the table next to me, and Talar has grown up in the northern parts of Sydney from an Armenian family, and she is now going to minister in Yaguna and still trying to work out how best to reach the Armenian community. We met Tim before, who has is now going back to his native North Shore, as far north as you can. I call it southern Queensland. And then we have Christine, and Christine is working our PowerPoints at the moment. Christine's the closest we've got to a somewhere person, really, in that she comes from Bosley Park and is moving to Fairfield, or she comes from Fairfield and is moving to Bosley Park. She's finished college here, and she and her husband are ministering there. Although, they went to Japan earlier this year and they thought they might go to Japan. So in her head, she's a nowhere person, though her body is still somewhere. And then Lucy we met, who wants to reach Mandarin people. Lucy was born in China and then came here when she was four. And then she went to North Sydney Girls High, but then she went back to China for a couple of years of education, then came back and lived in the hills, and then came to Sydney, New South Wales University, that's right, and then has worked here, there and everywhere. And she's a Mandarin-speaking Chinese girl who happens to be in this room tonight. But the location is an irrelevance to her in her life. Now let me show it to you with John. John, where's John? Come out here, John. John is a classic nowhere man. Aren't you?
I am, yes.
Okay, where were you born?
Born in Vancouver to a Canadian Scottish mother and an Assyrian father who was born in Iran but made his way to Canada via Baghdad. So.
Okay, so where did you grow up?
So early years in Vancouver, but then my parents decided that they would leave Vancouver and go to Fairfield in the western suburbs of Sydney. And so I grew up at Bosley Park, a few generations above Christine.
Yeah, and what did you go to school then, in Bosley Park?
Yeah, I went to school in Bosley Park. I was in a nominal Christian family, and in the school, I didn't know a single actual Christian in the whole school.
Right. Then after school, you went where?
After school, I somehow ended up getting to Sydney Uni to do science, and there I studied chemistry and applied mathematics, and realised that I was had enough of the lab and wanted to get into some sort of marketing role.
So what did you do?
So as it happened, I got a job working for a chemical trading company. And it started off as kind of medium, small, sort of little business. And it ended up becoming kind of the number two in Australia and just expanded and through sort of...
Through its marketing and salesman.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. anyway, through that, I got to travel around Australia and then overseas, visiting chemical factories and all that sort of thing.
But you moved overseas.
I did. That wasn't good enough, so I thought I should go on a working holiday. So I, against my dad's wishes, he said, don't do that. You'll never get paid the same amount of money. But I didn't listen to him. So I went off to the UK to do what you do as an Aussie. And did my 2 years over there in the chemical industry over there. And I was a pretty young Christian at the time.
Now, you became a Christian. How old were you when you became a Christian?
Became a Christian at 27, so just in that sort of 20s, just at the very end. And I was a Christian for a year, and then told my minister I was going to the UK and gave him heart palpitations, I'm sure, as a young Christian, sort of just dashed off.
How long were you in England?
I was in London for 2 years. Fortunately, got stuck into a good church there. Could have gone out the way. It's sort of weren't great options in the UK in London at that time. But I was there for 2 years and then returned back to Sydney.
What did you bring back with you?
Actually, I kind of came back and split up with an ex de facto who I'd been living with as a non-Christian for many years. And so I was a single bloke. And as it happened, though, I had a friend who knew some people from All College because she'd spent some time in New Zealand working with some All College graduates for 2 years in the university scene. She happened, this friend that I met in London, she happened to be visiting Sydney. And so we ended up, started dating and she got engaged to this bloke and moved out here for that. So
she's pretty well nowhere.
She's now a nowhere person.
Yeah. Okay. And now you've finished More College.
I am. We've decided to, after getting married here in Sydney, went back to London for 2 years to do some theological education at Cornhill. Did that for 2 years, bit of ministry in the UK, came back to Sydney so that I could come to this great place, More College, top place. And now, having just finished 3 years, we are shipping off again. And we're going to the southeast of England to minister there. And we want to be there for two reasons. One is for great gospel need in the UK, and the other is for my wife's father-in-law, who is elderly and going to need care in the next few years.
That's a nowhere, mate. Huh? He's nowhere, really. Fairfield Bosley Park does not feel home for you.
When you said, you know, they're citizens of the world, that was really kind of, that hit home a bit, because, you know, my daughters have got two passports. We feel a bit sort of fluid, where we could just move from one place to the other. The pain comes in the relationships.
And that means you won't be able to serve us in the federal parliament?
Definitely not, no.
Okay. Paul, come down the front, brother. Paul's going to join us next year. He's just finished first year, and he's replacing John as our resident, fully-fledged nowhere person. They're nearly all nowhere people in More College. Paul, where did you grow up?
A couple of country towns and then teenage years in Perth.
I see. And why did you go to Perth? Family went to Perth.
Family, yeah. We're following Dad's career.
Okay. So you went to university in Perth?
Yep, in Perth, yeah.
And then what did you do after uni?
Went to Melbourne. That was my first job.
Yeah, and then?
Just run
through what's happened since.
So went to Melbourne. That was my first engineering role, and then I came back to Perth. Then got married to Bronwyn, who I'd met in Melbourne. She'd been in Brisbane. Then we got married, we went to Perth.
But she comes from?
Adelaide.
Of course.
And then we went to the UK.
Yeah.
And then from there we went to Canada. And yeah. then we came back to Perth.
Uh-huh.
And then work transferred us a few years later to the US.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you can come back to Perth if you like, but there's no job there. If you want employment, you've got to come to Sydney. And here we are.
And when did you become a Christian in all this zigzagging around the world?
In Sydney, so about 5 years ago.
About 5 years ago, having gone all this through this tripping everywhere.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. And now you've finished first year college?
That's right, yep.
Which is good news, isn't it?
Hopefully. The exam results are still 2 weeks away.
Okay. We'll have you either way, brother. Thank you very much. You see, this is the growing world. This is a completely different concept of being a human than the concept in which the first generation lived. It's the dream of the baby boomers. It's the reality of the millennials. How are we going to evangelise them? How are we going to have a gospel ministry to such people? At last I've come to the topic, gospel ministry in the nowhere generation. You didn't know I was going to get there, did you? You see, we're ministering to the nowhere person who is in constant change. Three evangelistic things happen. One positive, two negatives. The positive is there are increased evangelistic opportunities all over the world because they are world citizens. They think, they're constantly meeting people. The negatives are the adaptations that they keep making reduce people's Christian identity. And the changes keep loosening Christian relationships. So let me take it through. Firstly, the positive, which is the main one, then the negative. The positive is the good news doesn't change whether people are nowhere people, somewhere people, or anywhere people. It's still the same gospel that's going to lead them to the Lord Jesus Christ. The gospel never changes. The people in their 20s have the lowest responsibility and the highest ability. Health, education, mobility. Wealth gives you the capacity to do anything. Marvellous, wonderful. To those who are given much, much will be required. You have great times to devote yourself to Christ like no other generation has had. And it's a great time to invest in the lives of others. The resources have never been greater. University ministries around Australia have never been larger. Tomorrow morning I'm off to the national training event. We think there's going to be 2,000 people at the national training event. That is fantastic. Across Australia, who else is coming tomorrow? Yeah, there we go. So there's all kinds of us heading down just tomorrow to the national training event. It's fantastic. Doesn't happen in other countries. Couldn't gather 2,000. Paul, how many could you gather in France? 120. That's three times our population, twice our population, 2.5 times our population, 120. Australia has such privileged opportunity of so many wonderful young men and women to preach the gospel throughout the world. And they are educated. I mean, it's really bad that they're spending so much time in their education, but on the other hand, we have an educated population who can teach the Bible like no other generation has ever been able to do. The nowhere generation is mobile and is connected. The 25-year-old male knows more people than anybody else. There's an extraordinary statistic come out of phone usages in Europe. And the overseas mission field is accessible to Australians. With our passport, we can go almost anywhere in the world. And what you are at 30 is what you'll be at 70. So here is the opportunity to deepen your gospel convictions and to deepen the gospel convictions of other educated young adults. It is a terrific moment in human history. The negatives? Well, the dropout rate amongst Christians is highest in their 20s. You can understand why. So this constant changing weakens your identity as a Christian as we adapt to changes. Our changes are all built on materialism and on careerism, on getting ahead, on our work. No longer am I identified as a Sydney sider, I'm identified as an engineer or as a chemist or as a
I've changed my personal identity just in accepting the career choices of the tertiary educated. Relationships with other Christians keep on being fractured as we change churches. And we don't have deep relationships. Facebook doesn't work like that. It helps relationships that exist, but it doesn't help create the relationships of any depth. And churches are built on the basis of localized family suburban life. Our churches, the strong ones, are nearly all family churches. And in the 20s and 30s, we're non-family people. They don't connect with us anymore. I mean, when we were young, even up to university, staying at home, because Australians do, we were the youth leader or the Sunday school teacher, but after uni we were pensioned off or we dropped out of doing it. We used to go to beach mission and camps, but after uni we didn't want to give up our holidays because we no longer had 6 months' holiday a year or whatever it is. And you haven't been at a new church long enough to be trusted to lead any new ministry. And so by the time you've established yourself in the new church, you're so busy at work and everything else, you haven't got time to take up the opportunities they'd want to give you. What you are at 30 is what you'll be at 70. If you've dropped out by then, you will have dropped out. This is the ministry area of Two Ways Ministries. Didn't know we were going to be here when we started off. We're just going to evangelise by teaching the Bible. But the more we've done it, the more we've seen that we're targeting the 18 to 30-year-olds. It is the critical group. The churches can't always do it. I'm a great believer in the churches, and I don't want us to be replacing church. I'm wanting to assist and help the churches, but the churches are built on somewhere. Unless it's a city church, it's not built on nowhere. And the people we're dealing with are nowhere people. And so that's why we want to build a network to help have people have relationships that go beyond the immediate. And we're not alone in what we're doing. It's not like Two Ways to Live is, Two Ways Ministries is the only one that's doing it. AFES is doing it for uni students. But AFES needs to help make the bridge out of university. City Bible Forums are doing it. Terrific ministry if you work in the centre of the city. But most people don't work in the centre of the city. But if you are, join up with City Bible Forum because they're terrific. Matthias Media is doing it. We've got Moore College is doing it. And Moore College is the hub of nowhere peoples. By the time you come to Moore College, you're a nowhere person. And you're being trained, unfortunately, for somewhere ministries. But you're a nowhere person. It's just one of the difficulties we have. And we've established other churches like FIEC churches, etc. But we are specialising more and more into this critical age group, challenging them to live single-mindedly and boldly for Christ. For if you're not deep in your convictions for Christ at 30, you're lost for 70. So that's what we're doing, creating this network of like-minded Christians that will support the work alongside other local churches working in and especially in Moore College, who have given us hospitality in this fine institution, to train tomorrow's evangelistic leaders. That is, we're challenging the rich young rulers of Christianity to get out and evangelise, to use their wealth, to use their youth, to use their ruling to take the gospel to the ends of the world. That's what we're doing. We're challenging them to give their all to follow Jesus, to live boldly and single-mindedly for him. For only then will the gospel spread around the world and in the future generations. And only then will the gospel be preserved in your own generation. So,
I'm actually going to ask you one final question.
Oh.
And that is, given that Two Ways Ministries is focusing on this demographic, as it were, this ministry, what are the actual plans for next year? What are you actually going to do in 2018?
The plans are about people. The structures The ministry's about people. The plans are about structures. Let me put it that way. What we're really doing is picking up with people. That's what matters. It's one-to-one networking that really matters. But in our structures, we're going to continue with our forums. So then this year, we've worked out fortnightly didn't work, so we're going for 4 months where we'll do it every Thursday, Friday night of the month. It's repeat Thursday, repeat Friday. And so March, May, August, September. And in August, we're going to stop talking about evangelism. We're going to run the forums evangelistically here in Moore College. Great place to do it in Moore College because this is the centre of nowhere Sydney Central. Is this somewhere? And the trajectories, we've had 10 trajectories now we've run with about 30 to 40 people at each one. And so it's about time we gathered everybody together. So we're running only 2 trajectory weekends this year, but much bigger. 120 or something like that people will be at each of those, so that the people who met in 30s or 40s this year or the year before will now meet up with a much bigger group, and so we can further reinforce the networking that we do. So we have to invent a new program to make the trajectory weekends work. We also run a once-a-year convention on the Queen's birthday weekend because nobody else does anything on the Queen's birthday weekend, and it's the middle of winter, and we fill this place. This year we filled it, so we're going to have to work out how we'll run a three-ring circus and use some of the other lecture theatres for the Queen's birthday weekend, and we haven't worked out what the topic's going to be yet. Depends. If we want to get a big crowd, love, sex and marriage, we want to get a small crowd, Deuteronomy. But we'll work it out.
Or money. That's the other one that drives them away, I found. Okay. Now, you were saying that you spoke up at Summer Life last weekend, so you're speaking around the place. What sort of speaking, or are you doing any writing in terms of your own personal output of material? What sort of stuff's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm speaking in a lot of places, but we're now trying to refine our invitations to the 18 to 30 group. Now, I speak at other church house parties or something like that. I'm going down next year to speak for Max Maddox, who used to be a mobile mission maintenance, but he's a farmer who runs farming ministries down in Melbourne, in Victoria. So I thought that's a far enough for a mission field to go to. So occasionally I go outside the 18 to 30, but you keep getting invited to go to lots and lots of places. Which one are you going to choose to, which one's not? We're purposely aiming to choose to go to those kinds of conferences which deal with the age group that we're aiming at, so as to continue to build the network. In terms of writing, yes, I have finished, and Helen is editing, because other people won't do the job, writing a commentary on 1 and 2 Timothy, which we're about to send to the publisher in about 2 weeks' time, which it'll be lovely to get off the desk at last. And I've written about 100,000 words on the subject of the Holy Spirit, which is going to be published in Matthias Media, which now needs to be trimmed back to about 60,000. 60,000 readable words is better than 100,000 unreadable ones, generally, you would say.
And then you've also got to get them in the right order. That's also
important. Oh, no one told me that.
Philip, thanks very much. Thank you. There's lots to pray about in what Philip has been speaking about just over the last few minutes, about our nation, about the state of our nation and the challenges we face as Christians, about the generation that's rising up, that faces, on the one hand, such opportunities and riches and wealth and ability and capacity for ministry, and on the other hand, a mission field and a climate and an evangelistic soil that is tough. There's lots to pray about. I think we should pray. Why don't you just, with the person just next to you, just in twos and threes, just spend a few minutes praying for the evangelism of our nation, for the generation that we've heard about today, for Two Ways Ministries and the work it's doing, and for anything else that's come up in your own heart and mind as you've listened to Philip tonight. So let's just spend a few moments praying together, and then I'll close in prayer in just a few minutes' time. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the power of your gospel. We thank you that you do the impossible through the Lord Jesus Christ and through the power of your Spirit, that you speak your truth into people's hearts and that you turn them around and bring them to you, no matter how hard those hearts are. We thank you so much, Father, that you've done this for so many of us here in this room, that you've done the impossible in our lives. And we pray that you would, Father, give us your Spirit to keep speaking your word into other people's lives, that you might do this for them as well. We thank you for all we've heard tonight, Father, not only about the challenges we face, but about the wonderful opportunities. We thank you for the work of Philip and for all the work the Two Ways Ministries and the team are doing, for Wendy and for Sophie and the support staff and for everybody who's helping on the team. And we pray, Father, that you would prosper and bless this work, not only in this next year, but in years to come. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Well, who you are at 30 is who you are at 70, we heard about five times tonight. And that's the amazing thing about Philip, really. Who he was at 30, challenging rich young rulers at university campuses to live single-heartedly and boldly for Christ, is who he is at 70, challenging young people to live boldly and single-mindedly for Christ. And I'm terribly grateful. I'm grateful to God. I don't want to embarrass him. I'm grateful to God for what God has done in his life, that he is still doing this at 70 with such vigour and with such insight and with such skill. That when other people are off caravanning around Australia at his age, he's instead travelling around Australia speaking the gospel to people and raising up a new young network, a new generation of people to live for Christ. Not so much a grey nomad as a grey prophet, you might say. Who wants to continue to do this work and invest in this new generation. And we should continue to support him, I think, in it. To pray for him, to pray for strength and health. He's got wonderful strength and health at present. Pray that God would continue to give it to him so he can keep doing this wonderful work. And to support him as well, of course, by giving money to support the work that Two Ways Ministries does and to pay for the work that we're hearing about tonight that is just so exciting. I certainly would love to see Philip keep doing this for as long as God gives him strength. And the little ministry he's set up, the team he's set up around him with Wendy and Sophie offering support and organising him and putting him on the road and looking after everything, that team of support and the student ministry team that he's assembled is a wonderful team that does support him and does help this whole ministry happen. It does cost money, though. And as you'll see on the front of this card, it costs somewhere around $220,000 each year to run the Two Ways Ministries ministry. Hardly any of that, I want you to know, goes to Philip himself. You'll see here this little pie chart, if you go back to the pie chart, that gives you some kind of idea of the breakdown of where the money goes. The largest bulk of it goes to paying the student ministry bursaries, to pay for those 8 students to work with Philip every year, to be trained by him and to influence the college that way and to go out from here. The bursary and training costs are considerable. The trajectory conferences cost money, not only because we subsidise the conferences to make them as accessible and affordable for the students or the young people as possible, but the organisational costs of Sophie and Wendy running and driving those conferences. Then there's a section there that's very nicely and euphemistically called Enabling Philip's Ministry. And that's basically Wendy and Sophie running Philip's life for him. It's basically getting him on the road, organising him, getting to where he needs to be, running his diary, organising everything. And they work very hard so that Philip can be as effective as he possibly can. That's that cost. And you said that little sliver of blue is direct ministry expenses. Those are just Philip's travel costs and entertainment and books and computer costs. That's the money that goes to him personally to cover expenses. And there's some miscellaneous office running costs. So as you can see, it's a budget that's all about the people we're investing in, the student ministers, the trajectory conferences and forums, and the team that keeps Philip running and keeps him on the road and keeps it all happening. And so I want to really encourage you that it's time to invest and support him in this and keep this happening. It must keep going. It's a very exciting and very worthwhile ministry, and we need to support it. And that's what this support card is about. You want to grab this out now because we're all going to fill it in. In time-honoured Philip fashion, everybody fills in the card. Even if you just want to say hello, you fill in the card and let us know you've been here. And tell us how you'd like to support Two Ways Ministries on into the future. And the way to fill in the card actually is to start at the bottom. So you start with your name and address with the details, and then you work your way up. You might want to say, yes, please tell me, give me information about those Friday forums, Thursday and Friday forums, and the trajectory weekends. If that's the age and stage, if that's who you are and you want to find out about those, please tick that box. If you'd like to receive email updates about what's continuing to happen, you can tick that next box. And then the section at the top of the form, you can indicate how and how much you'd like to give to support this ministry as it goes forward. And you can see there that you can give either just as a credit card donation, either once off or as a recurring donation, or you can do a bank transfer, or if you still use a check. And I'm guessing that the Nowhere people probably don't use checks, but there's a few nation builders still in the room who use checkbooks. If that's how you want to do it, then there's also a checkbook there as well. I'm going to give you a minute or two just to fill that in the next moment. In fact, if the musicians want to come up, because we're going to sing our final song in just a moment, and I'm just going to give you a minute to fill that in, and when the final song is playing, some boxes will come around and we'll collect these cards where you can indicate your support. I'll just give you a second to fill those in. Friends, if you've completed that card, then we're going to sing our final song together now, and some boxes will come around and you can pop the card in. If you did complete the card and you wanted to contribute by bank transfer, those details are still on the handout that you've received. So if you put the card in, don't despair. You've still got those details to do when you get home. That's if you're an old person like me who uses their computer. If you're a young person, you have already transferred the money on your phone. I know that's the case. But if you need to do that, that's on this. Friends, it is something we can all contribute to. Not all of us are young anymore. Not all of us are rulers. But as Philip says, pretty much all of us are rich. And in the resources that God has given us, we should support ministries like this that are doing such wonderful work. Let's stand together. We're going to sing. Some boxes will come around and you can pop the card in. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Hopefully we'll all gather again next year at the Queen's Birthday Convention. What it'll be about, who knows what. But if it's as good as tonight, it'll be well worth coming. Thanks again for being with us tonight. Good night.